Success Leaves Clues podcast with Robin Bailey and Al McDonald. Have you ever wondered what makes someone successful? What are they doing that's different? How do they achieve greatness? We believe that success leaves clues. In this series, we are interviewing very successful people from different walks of life to hear their stories. We'd like to remind our listeners that the views expressed in this podcast are those of our guests and not necessarily those shared by our hosts. Today's episode is sponsored by Life and Legacy Advisory Group. Discover our commitment to our clients. At Life and Legacy, building wealth, securing your family's future, giving back, and creating a lasting legacy are not just values, but a way of life. Let us guide you toward a future aligned with what matters most to you. We're also brought to you by Aria Benefits. If you're a business leader challenged with talent attraction, employee engagement, or supporting mental health, we can help. Use your benefits package as the key to unlock your workforce. Now here's your hosts, Robin Bailey and Al McDonald.
Welcome back to the Success Leaves Clues podcast. I'm your host, Robin Bailey, back at it again with my business partner and co-host, Al McDonald. Al, what are you seeing these days?
Well, really excited to be speaking with our guest today because I think we're going to pick up a lot of tricks and tips on what we do. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. And once I get the bio done, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about our own experience. And I think we'll learn a little more, but talk about an elevated experience like, wow. So I'm thrilled to welcome a person I recently met and just hit it off with immediately. And I know there's future conversations coming. Kazim Verghee is a serial entrepreneur, creative technologist, and the founder of Startwell, a Toronto-based innovation campus that blends co-working, media production, hospitality, and event experiences under one roof. You got to see this, folks. Let me tell you, go for a tour. You will not be disappointed. Now, with a background spanning broadcasting, startup incubation, and digital transformation, Kazim brings a unique lens to the future of work and community building. At Startwell, he's redefining what it means to support entrepreneurship, not just with space, but with meaningful human connection and storytelling. Whether behind the mic on Startwell's podcast or designing immersive experiences for founders, Kazim is constantly asking, how can we better support people on their journey to build something that matters? It's always fun to have another podcaster on the show, so welcome.
Thanks. Absolutely, man. It's a pleasure to be here. And before jumping on, I was taking a look at some of the back episodes. You guys, what episode number are you even on? You've been recording a lot of conversations.
248, I think.
Congratulations. Yeah. That takes a lot of stick-to-itiveness to be able to keep it going. And it's an honor to be on the show.
Well, thank you for that. It's funny, we were chatting about this the other day, actually with the guest that we recorded with at your studio. And he had said, well, you know, one of the reasons behind his success was he didn't quit. And I said to Al, when I came up with the idea for the podcast, I said, once we start, we are not stopping. And we just never did, right? And in the beginning, you don't see a lot of results. You don't get a lot of, you know, what you're looking for, what you kind of dream of when you start a podcast. But at some point, that starts happening, right? And I knew, Kazim, that started happening when I would have people's teams, not just people, but people's teams reach out for their leadership. Hey, can we be on the podcast?
So that's cool.
Yeah, we're starting to see some of those things. So whoever's out there, just keep going. But Kazim, I got to start with the experience at your location. And before we do that, I got to send a shout out to our good friend, Kara Wilson Oliver, because that's how I found you.
Right.
Because I was reaching out to a number of people and I said, I'm looking for the space. I'm looking to create this elevated experience for the people that we record with in person. And she's like, oh my God, you got to meet Kazim. Go for a tour. And of course, even the tour was this elevated experience,
it was awesome.
Right?
Was it?
Like Hassan took us around.
Oh,
like
yeah.
From the moment
he's
you
amazing.
Walk in, he's incredible. Like we have six guiding principles in our company. And we say, if you do the first five, you automatically get number six, which is the wow experience. And from the moment you walk in to the moment you leave, that's what you get. And as Hassan is a big part of that. So you've done a great job at attracting really good people into your organization.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, is that a question or?
No, it was just an initial comment.
It can be if you want it to be.
It was just an initial comment because it was a real pleasure to record at your studio. I think you've done such a good job and we'll definitely be back for more. But here comes the question.
Okay.
Because I think you've got a really interesting background. You know, your career journey spans music, media, tech before founding Startwell. Can you walk us through that path, perhaps, and how those worlds influenced this whole Startwell concept? Because I think, again, if you haven't been for a tour, I highly recommend that you do, because it's not just for podcasting, it's meeting space. It's the unique concept that I've never seen before prior to meeting you.
Yeah, and it's true. And it's taken a number of years to get to where we are. So I'll do it for your audiences. Let me give you my kind of like current day status of what Startwell is. It's not just the name on a mug. But yeah, let me break it down. And then I can backtrack to kind of give you that like career experience and life experience, I think, that helped me shape this brand into what it is. And some of those learnings are not just mine, you know, they're learnings of looking at our clients and being able to evolve and being ready for that. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But current day, Startwell, for anyone who's not in Toronto, who doesn't know us, we're a 20,000 square foot campus right on King Street West, which is a downtown major artery that's an east-west street that has a streetcar running along it. So wicked access and linkages to transit and to the financial core. And it's purposefully located outside of the financial core. So I built this campus with the intention of gathering corporate teams outside of their everyday, you know, familiar kind of space, which might be tube-lit over air-conditioned financial core towers. And so today what we do is we kind of have created a home away from home for corporate teams to gather and typically host offsites. That's our number one thing, where teams of between 2 to 200 people will come here for a full day session or multi-day session for offsites. And then executive teams and other working teams will come here for smaller meetings that they might have. And even things like sales kickoffs, that might be mid-sized 50 sales team people come in for a few days to just get aligned for the quarter. So we're a place where people gather, but my approach to enabling that is to enable the way that people work to be, I would say, easier, more comfortable, and more enabled. And I think there's a lot of tools that people don't bring to the table in the way that we work in Canada, because for the most part, people aren't empowered to feel that they can own their job in many ways. And so that's where we had to learn in the 7 years that Startwell has been here on King Street about how people, when they come together, how they meet, what their apprehensions are, what their anxieties are, how we could take some of that emotional baggage away to make them feel comfortable. And that's where we evolved this really hospitality forward approach of having, you mentioned Hassan, who's at our front desk. Having a front desk is the first experience when you walk in the building, right? That has a complimentary espresso bar. And I always tell him and I always tell my staff, if you travel the world and go to any hotel, even a Four Seasons, right? Another Canadian brand we all love and celebrate, but at the pinnacle of luxury hospitality experience, you will not be offered a free complimentary cappuccino when you roll out of your room and go to the reception. So for us, it's about taking the wallet out of the equation and focusing on who the people are that come in the door and why they need to do what they need to do and enabling them. So the next layer to that above this, like just meeting and events, is we do media production. So this is where props to Kara for connecting us. Of course, it's awesome that she did. The introduction to Startwell as a place to record media was really cool because it's not necessarily a primary function here. And so the people in the know that we do it. And so, yeah, we've taken top tier media production and broadcasting tools, baked them into our venues. So the quality that you guys know in the podcast studio that you've recorded in is also at every stage that's at Startwell. So if you brought your team, let's say, to host a session, or you're doing an external corporate event with clients or sales leads, you could stream and record the content they deliver on stage. And as we all know, that's a big part of the marketing playbook today, is having assets that you can kind of authentically share and expand your network of opportunity through. So that's what Startwell is today. How we got here, at least in terms of my career history, might be even longer of a spiel, but let's let's go, okay? So I'm a Canadian who was born in Edmonton. When I was 5, I moved to Calgary. When I was 11, it was the big recession happening at the end of the 80s and the early 90s, right? And here's a question for you guys. Do you remember how high your mortgage might have gotten at that time if you had one?
In terms of interest rates, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I had a mortgage, and I think I bought my first house in, I'm going to say about 87, 88. And when I had to renew my mortgage, I believe it was 18%. Now, at the same time, Canada savings bonds were up around 20%. And people probably don't even know what Canada savings bonds are anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
That's where interest rates were in the late 80s and early 90s. Yep.
And so it was a tough time. And I think it's an interesting thing to call out because I don't hear too many people currently who are freaking out a little bit about our economic situation, knowing the boom bust cycles before 2008, right? Which seems like a little minor blip. But that was the context in which my parents kind of had said, okay, you know, they're originally from Kenya and they knew people that stayed back post Idi Amin, post the uncertainty in the region in the 70s, while they moved forward and moved to Canada. And, you know, they always kind of like thought, hey, those guys did pretty well staying there. Maybe we should give it another shot. Let's take the kids back to Africa. And so my story is very much framed by my parents' story and our lineage. I think everyone who looks back at their ancestors will say the same thing. And what's really cool is I'll say this, my dad's an entrepreneur. So even the thought of like leaving Canada, which had been his home for 20 years or whatever, and moving us all over to Nairobi amidst the, you know, second ever dictator in power, all things told, it was a dictatorship at the time. So it wasn't a free market economy. And yet, despite that, thinking that he can navigate the groundwork, create a business, pay the bills, I think that was both commendable and it was also really exciting because it set the groundwork of us to feel as children that like we can do the same. And I think that was the beginning of my entrepreneurial zest, was to say, if all else fails, you know, you can always kind of create value for yourself in life. And the means of doing that was hustling some cash somehow, building a business. So when I was a young teen in Nairobi, the story is quite long, so I'll cut to the main keynotes here. But essentially, like I moved there when I was 11, right? Went to British private school, went to a bunch of different schools, met a bunch of different people from all over the world because the United Nations Environment Program World Headquarters is in Nairobi. So you have all these diplomat kids from all over the place, which is just expansive in terms of getting the cultural lessons from all these people in one place. I wouldn't have had that in Calgary if we'd stayed. So I got a good lens on the world. And I was sitting there as a Canadian kind of craving communication in the way that we have it here. And especially in the 90s, where for anyone who's young, doesn't know about the 90s listening to this, you would walk into a denim shop to try on jeans and be invited to a birthday party for someone you don't even know. And you'd go and make new friends. Like for me, that's Canada in the 90s, right? So feeling like that was not something that I was, you know, immediately in anymore was a bit discordant in this dictatorship of Nairobi, of Kenya. So when the internet came to town, I was one of the first people that got online. I was always kind of like a techno geek from being a young age and loved computers. And I had been reading about the internet. Like, this is crazy. I'd been reading magazines from all over the world, computing magazines that were talking about the internet in the mid 90s. And so in 95, late 95, I think, I got online because a friend of mine was a politician's son who got exclusive access to the first ISP in Kenya. I was 15 at the time. I found out where that connection came from, and I went there after school. And I walked through the mud after school in a very unsafe kind of part of town as the sun was setting and my mom was, you know, no doubt having a heart attack. And I found this little house. And in this little house, there was a stack of servers and a bunch of modems connected to them. In fact, no, wait, there was one server and there were four modems connected to them. And you could only have four people dialing into that ISP at the time. And I asked them a million questions. And I think that's, again, a core thing that early on I learned about entrepreneurship. You've got to be able to dig for information if you're going to create value. You have to understand, you know, the context of that value. And so, yeah, I learned everything about in that like 1 hour session with these guys before I ran home. I learned everything about how they perceived the internet, its possibilities, and the technical aspect of running a server. And it just obsessed me. It was everything. And so I became their first internet reseller in East Africa by helping that nonprofit actually connect people to the internet. And they hooked me up with a bag of modems, and I would be after school going all over the place in Kenya, just like connecting people up to the internet and teaching them what the internet was. And then I ended up deciding to come back to Canada for university. I got into McGill and I went to McGill and I lived in Montreal. And that was a really cool time because there was this like weird hacker culture that defined the startup ecosystem in Montreal at the time. And one of the companies that made it pretty big and then it floundered was a company called Zero Knowledge. Zero Knowledge was a crypto company and they were like into digital cryptography and security stuff way ahead of its time. But they owned one of the campus computer stores at McGill that I worked at. So I started doing like moonlighting for Zero Knowledge, doing like web development work. And I was building computers as my kind of how I paid my rent. And I also started DJing. So I was into music because going back to the Kenya thing, this is crazy. When I was like I think I must have been five or six, I started listening to community radio off the, what was it, CJSW, the Calgary University Radio Station, on a little ghetto blaster I had. And that ghetto blaster could record on tapes. So I had this duffel bag when we moved to Kenya of tape recordings from a Saturday afternoon show with DJs. And this is like from the 80s, right? So DJs were like really raw back then, cutting all this music. And that was my source of music when I lived in Kenya. So for the whole time I was in Kenya through junior high, high school, O levels, A levels, I was listening to these DJ mixes and thinking about how they mixed it and how I would remix it. So when I got to McGill, I started building a sound system together, got turntables, got records. I started DJing and founded a couple record labels to publish some of the music that I was really into, which was mainly like Indian electronic music. So funky South Asian inspired electronic music. That led me to coming out of university, forming relationships with the British Broadcasting Corporation and partnering up with their Asian network in Birmingham. And lots of stories there. But basically, I think that the high note is I got into media at McGill and I got into streaming because when I would DJ, what we'd do is, this is early for this stuff, but connect a Winamp server out of like a physical computer. We'd take like a big desktop computer down to the gig, connect it into the soundboard and stream it just to some like random website that maybe five people would log into and post that onto different IRC servers. So people all over the world could tune in to this gig in like the Plateau in Montreal. And that was like in 2000, 2001. So I was always into streaming media, self-taught web along the whole evolution of HTML and the CSS pre-JavaScript. And then like after university, I was thinking, what should I do? You know, because I'm really into media. I founded a DJ school in Montreal and that was going well. I had a curriculum. I was geeking out on making it serious. But it was cold. It was winter. And I decided post-McGill that I didn't want to live in that winter anymore. So I went back to Nairobi, did a bunch of stuff. I helped the Yellow Pages go online. I built their web development agency. And then was itching to move on because I was young, right? I was in my 20s. So that took me actually to New York. I convinced over a number of telephone calls that required scratch cards that I would go down the street to like refill from a kiosk. I'd have to pay him cash to load up a scratch card to come back to my apartment that I lived in with my brother to make a phone call to call New York to convince this one company to hire me. And I did. And it was called the Project for Public Spaces. This is a public space think tank that was founded in the 70s, inspired by like the work of Jane Jacobs and William White and these people. They came up with a methodology called placemaking, where you take a space, like a physical public space, and through this methodology of doing two things, assessing by observational analysis, setting up cameras, watching people flow through the space, and then first-person survey data, talking to the people that use the space, you can actually kind of come up with what's not working and make recommendations for how to reform it. And placemaking is about taking space, but transforming it into a place where a place is, I guess, defined by having emotional connection to the people that use it, a sense of ownership, feeling of care and belonging and all these things. So my thought in convincing these guys to hire me was, you know, I didn't necessarily want to live in New York, but that's where the job was. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I think when people talk about entrepreneurs and they might get the culture wrong, but like there's this kind of like you don't even perceive risk, right? Personal risk. You just have to kind of do what you need to do. And the upside on seeing your vision actualized is more exciting than anything. So even getting that job, I remember they needed to see me in person for a last round interview before they could officially hire me. And they were creating the role for me because I had told them I wanted to do was take their methodology and digitize it. Because for me, the internet was the greatest public space. So how do we make it better? And so I convinced my dad to give me like, I think it was like $1,000 for the plane ticket. And it was a one-way ticket. And he was like, what are you going to do if it doesn't work out? And I was like, I don't know. I'll figure it out though. And so I went to New York and it was this crazy ride where like I got the job. Then I had to come back to Toronto. I was staying on a friend's couch while I waited for my TN visa support documentation. And then I went to the border on a bus. I found what's the route to get into America that's the easiest to get a TN visa because there's different ports that are different difficult. So I went through Montreal and like went through some podunk town to like cross over to the US on a Greyhound bus and got the visa at the border. And I was now working in New York. And it was a crazy situation because the apartment that I had arranged for to live in wasn't available anymore when I got there. And I was like effectively homeless in New York, but I had a job. And that was pretty crazy. So what I ended up doing is I just, you know, like back in the 90s, you go backpacking somewhere around the world and you have this big backpack. So I had a backpack with all my stuff in it. And I went to a DJ gig of a Bhangra DJ that I knew through the internet called DJ Rekha. Shout out to DJ Rekha, because I went to her gig in the first week that I was in New York there. And she looked at me, as people in New York tend to do. And she looked at my backpack and she knew I was homeless. Like, I wasn't sleeping in alleys or anything. This is the first like night I needed a place to crash. And she sent me to another gig and she said, look, if at 2 a.m. you need a place to crash, come with me to Queens. And it was cool because I went to this gig. I started DJing with the DJ whose party it was because we hit it off musically. And I was just playing off his music and we were playing back to back. And a guy I knew who's Portuguese, who had been in Nairobi on vacation, who I met when he was on vacation, rolled in. And he said, I live in the Lower East Side. You need a place to crash? Come over. And I stayed there for 2 weeks until I got an apartment. But so all these twists and turns were really interesting because it's about the tenacity. I think there was a mention that we started about tenacity, right? And not giving up. And I think that's core to entrepreneurship. So for me, I was there for a year. I learned the placemaking methodology. And then I had my sense of how to digitize it. I came to Toronto and I founded a studio called Design Guru that was all inbound for 10 years. And we were world famous for the work that I did, which was digital placemaking. That led us to work with everyone from Coca-Cola, like launching all sorts of brands in Canada, you know, Kia. We launched the Kia Soul car in North America. Mm-hmm. So it was doing like agency work before we were defining ourselves as an agency. And it was all digital placemaking. So strategy, design, development around digital communication platforms online. And that turned into a venture accelerator in a way, or ideation studio, where I started kind of getting, when Facebook came about, like 2008, all of our clients were asking for copycat software. So we weren't into that. So what I basically started doing is developing products like SaaS products internally, moving away from client work, and then creating these software startups. And now I'll get a bit fast and come back to Startwell. But like basically the last startup that I created was very ambitious for the time. Okay. So this is like 2012, I think. 2013. It started by, I was basically looking at YouTube as this wild west of content and how YouTube has always been very poor at, and even today, at providing a curational kind of interface. Like people can't find stuff that they're looking for. And the promise is that the algorithm will just deliver you what you love, right? So particularly I was looking at Bollywood and I was interested in how Bollywood content was making its way onto YouTube. And it was, at the time, the number one place where people would watch these films online, but they were all like ad-supported and it was really tough to find what you're looking for. So I created this like automated, I guess today you would call it AI, but this scripted indexing website that would crawl YouTube for Bollywood titles, index them, catalog them, and create beautiful like Netflix-looking interface to play it with a YouTube embedded player on our website. And that was like MVP. And then I was like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take all my savings, all my money out of my various businesses and go to India and license a bunch of content. And that's what I did, is I actually built our own really interesting catalog and learned the licensing business and licensed 250 or 300 films from various different distributors and filmmakers and stuff. And then built a whole stack that was basically like Netflix before Netflix was in India. And it was called Get Filmy, and lots of twists and turns because I had to shop for capital all over the world. So this gave me deep insight now into the venture capital world and family offices and all of this sort of stuff. And then at the end of all that, where things got sketchy on this potential massive deal that me and a few partners I put together were working on, I put the brakes on it and decided to take a job. I was going to be a company man. The software stack that I had built was running on SoftLayer, which is a cloud infrastructure company out of Texas, or was, and they had a startup program. So I was invited to run their startup program across Canada. And I was like, okay, I'm getting married at this time. This is like the startup stuff has burnt all my money. And I took a job and I was running the startup program across Canada for SoftLayer. And then they got bought by IBM. So I got hired in IBM, and I was running their startup program for a little while across Canada. And I still saw a lot of need for nurturing and support of early stage entrepreneurs in Canada. And I didn't see the corporate entities as being able to themselves do it because it's too long term in the investment cycle. So I was very interested in startup ecosystem, and that was my world for a little while there. And then I joined a few family offices investing first round checks into companies. And again, for me, it came back to place where I was like, okay, these companies need to learn from each other. It's not just a matter of like putting VCs on their board or family offices on the board and then waiting until they have a board meeting to get instruction on how to run their companies or so on. So that's what Startwell was founded as. Originally, Startwell was founded as this kind of place where early stage founders and teams could lever connectivity to be able to grow in ways that otherwise they wouldn't be able to on their own. And it was crazy because the first location was a 1,000 square foot storefront on St. Clair Avenue West near my house. Within a couple months, I was like, this isn't big enough. We need to grow. I found a building that was derelict, which is one half of our campus on King Street West. The previous company had gone bankrupt and no one wanted to rent this place. It was a mess. I stole the keys from the landlord. And for a week, I was in and out of here shopping it to startups and getting them signed a letter of intent at the end of the tour to say that they'll commit if we renovate it to having an office here. I took that money, the commitment to VCs to say, hey, let's do this. This is a new model. And no one could pull the trigger quick enough because I got a call from the landlord's office saying, give us a check by the end of the week or give us the keys back. You're either going to be a tenant or you're not. So I did the crazy thing. And I basically, out of a home equity line of credit, you know, wrote the checks for Startwell and signed a 10-year multi-million dollar lease that I was on the hook for. And that was the beginning of Startwell. And that was in 2017. And our first foot forward, again, was early stage startup focused co-working. But coming towards the pandemic already, and there was all these stories along the way of growth and pivoting and kind of improving quality of service as the clientele evolved. But by 2019, I'd already started taking a lot of the office space that we have here and converting it into meeting and event space, because what I found was the market was getting saturated with co-working, right? So WeWork, Regus, all these brands, we're coming in and under cost offering office space in the hottest time in the hottest market, right? We were at 1% commercial vacancy in 2019. And you could get a hot desk somewhere for like $200 or $150. It didn't make sense. So we started moving into meeting and event space. And then when the pandemic hit, this sounds counterintuitive, but I was breathing a sigh of relief, man. I got to tell you guys, I don't know if you've heard this on the podcast from anyone else who's an entrepreneur, but when I had to fire all my staff and all my clients left and there was zero money in the bank and it started going negative, I was the happiest I had ever been. Like, and part of that is because I was walking around with a screwdriver, re-renovating once again, putting capital improvements into this real estate that I was on the hook for millions of dollars with and didn't know how to earn money at that time. But because I was empowered by the 10-year vision I had for this place, which I was anxious about pre-pandemic because I had a 10-year lease. So I was thinking, the stuff I want to accomplish in that period, I'm going to be having to move into another property by then. So what I did is I decided the pandemic's going to be an accelerator for this brand. And I really looked in the mirror hard and I was like, how do I want this company to evolve in the next 5 to 10 years? And how can I do that now? Because I have a short-term window that no one's breathing down my neck that I can actually execute on. It was a massive time. It was a massive time because that's when I went deep with media production. I'd already done some, you know, in my past life as a DJ, record label owner, but I didn't know cinematography. We had a property around the corner there. I don't think you guys saw. It was on Niagara Street. It was a 4-year experiment, 4,000 square foot building, 16 foot ceiling, and it had a psych, which is a curved wall. The wall blends into the floor. Hmm. And I used that building to prototype Startwell's media production stack. And that was a crazy adventure. I mean, this is like 10 hours of storytelling, but like that studio, so it was a building that it was basically a detached square with a parking lot on the front in a residential neighborhood, not the sexiest thing to drive commercial revenues out of, and small. And I had rented it because we had a commercial office tenant that was going to take it, a cannabis company. And so we had furnished it as office in 2019 and spent 6 months gutting and renovating it, all leased property. But with the pandemic, I sat on it for a year. I said, I don't know what I need to do with this. Then the second year is when I actually built the curved wall. And I started bringing in media producers to say, hey, produce here for free. I just want to see how you work. And I learned how they work. And then I brought on one staffer who comes from media to help me. We decked out the place with equipment like crazy. And I started prototyping a model where creative producers from agencies would come in and do their work for commercial clients using our tool. So now they didn't need to carry around gaffer equipment and cameras and lenses. We had everything. But that was very expensive, and it was also pretty crazy because I just was doing it as like to jump the learning curve. Learned a lot, and then created a production company in-house here at Startwell to execute on all the same stuff that we were bringing people in to do. And we did great work for all sorts of brands like Nobis and Charlotte Tilbury, a makeup brand. And all this cool stuff was like commercial marketing advertising content. But none of that really yielded on the revenue, you know, like specifically for real estate. Real estate's always the smallest line item in a production budget. And post-production's always the biggest one. So that's where I kind of like took it a step forward. And when the landlord positioned the building as something he wanted to get rid of, it was too rich for my blood. And I said, okay, we'll sell it. And in November, we moved back. That was last year. And doubled down on King Street. And that's when I gutted, you know, the floor that's in front of the podcast studio that you walk through?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The lounge and the high tops.
Yep.
I built that in November in 2 weeks. I had contractors come in 1 week. We did the demo. The second week, we did the cleanup, fixturing, and furnishing. So within 3 weeks, I had clients of pulling out of the other building. We had clients doing bookings here in that space. So that was pretty exciting because I closed last year now with this new positioning of being entirely dedicated to meetings and events. And what we did is took all the learnings from that building and baked them in to the current campus. And we have this like amazing media production capacity at all these, what, 3 stages and 2 studios.
It's amazing. Kazem, I want to thank you. You just took me down memory lane.
Oh, yeah?
So you talked about, well, the mortgage rates, the high interest rates of the 80s, cassette tapes, backpacking, and Greyhound buses, all parts of when I was a younger individual. So I could relate to every one of those things that you talked about. That was funny. Brought me back.
Nice.
So that's an amazing journey. I want to talk a little bit because one thing that you've hit on, I think, like you keep coming back to it, it just weaves its way through your entire story there,
yeah,
is this feeling of community that is part of what you have at Startwell and part of what you've tried to create and just that environment to be welcoming. So, I mean, talk a little bit more about that. What does that mean to you? And especially in terms of entrepreneurship and the entrepreneur community in Toronto. How do you think Startwell fits into that?
Okay, this is a tough one to crack because I think, I'll say it like this, like when I went to university in the 90s and early 2000s, right, there were no schools of entrepreneurship. Fundamentally, we had schools of management. That wasn't long ago, was a couple decades ago,
yeah,
right? And even now, I think the traditional, you know, university structures that we have in Canada, the higher educational institutions, are ill-prepared to afford students the experience that's required in learning entrepreneurship. So
right.
I think scholastically, like they'll do good at a kind of like teaching people from textbooks. And there are programs that are really interesting where they are creating projects out of entrepreneurial ventures to teach firsthand how people can build businesses, which I think is good.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a culture in Canada that is antithetical to entrepreneurship. And my lens on that is framed by technology, where I would assume the barriers to entry in founding a tech startup are like lower than ever, right? It's crazy. If you look at it, like the ability that Canadians have to create companies is so far and beyond most other countries in the world, in the sense that I could go online right now, register a company, call up a bank, get a bank account, and be transacting by the end of the day.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's really empowering if you know how that's relevant to your ability to earn. So I think we're well prepared in terms of infrastructure, and it's only going to get better as the banks bring on these, like, you know, are competing with fintechs and stuff. So I think that's good stuff. I think we do suffer, though, from an inability to provide financing for entrepreneurship. I see nothing wrong with early stage companies taking on debt if they have to. And I think that the BDC does a good job at making that available in some ways. But what I find is we don't have creative finance mechanisms that encourage entrepreneurship. And part of that is also this critique of like how schools teach it. So I think that that's kind of a big problem that I've seen, where to get through that first stage, second stage, third stage founder or cycle takes a lot of heartache for people. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, you're looking at massive failure across the board in Canadian enterprise until people like learn what they're doing. And a big part of that, which is actually hitting home lately in a lot of people I'm talking to, this is something that I didn't think about till recently, but as a founder operator, especially bootstrap, you're always saying, okay, well, what resources do I need to execute? And I'll wear the hats of 20 people. Mm-hmm. And that's really great. But as soon as you start building teams, you say, hey, wait, I want A players that can at least do 5% of what I can do. And I think that this is something that's interesting. It's a ripple effect that we have to consider, which is if we don't en masse have an employment base in Canada that's educated to work in entrepreneurial ventures, right? If they're coming from working at CIBC their whole life to rehire into a fintech, their performance won't necessarily be excellent because they have a lot of cultural catch-up to do. Agility is not a facet of life in the conventional industries and institutional kind of companies that we have in Canada. So that's something that's interesting to me. At the same time, I think, you know, Canada's tech literacy is very high. And so that's a really good thing where I think people will be able to negotiate kind of entrepreneurship paths for themselves in the future because they understand the tools that are at their disposal. But it's a ping pong thing if I talk about this for long, because I don't have all the answers on where in the next 5 years there'll be opportunities. See, I've already pigeonholed myself by talking about technology too much, because if I pull it back a little bit, I'm going to say, here, let me give you my crystal ball, okay? So there's problems, as I've painted the picture. There's problems with how to bring people up to speed on learning how to run a company, okay? Getting started, they can get started. But running a company and growing a revenue base and building it in a way that's sustainable so that they're not constantly going back to the bank or constantly doing capital-intensive projects that require outside finance that could never be paid back. I see a lot of that, right? And that's Silicon Valley emulation mode for the last couple decades in Canada, where especially in tech, people have said capital is not just a necessary input, it's the input. And everything comes from capital. Mm. And when they start thinking like that, coming back to your question, they're not thinking about their company as a community. They're not thinking about cultural values. And you see this widget factory mentality where labor is replaceable. No one's expected to even consider that they could have a career at a company. Forget like someone saying, hey, baby boomer dad, you don't know what you're talking about. What if someone wanted to hang up their hat and just be chill for 10 years and invest in their work? You know, they don't trust that that's a possibility. So I think that's a problem. But again, where I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity in the crystal ball that's in front of me is Canada on a global stage has a lot to offer, not just in our raw materials and our resources, which have been for so long, maybe because of the capital intensive nature of their extraction and exploitation, but for so long, those resources have been only manipulated by very few companies, right? Mm-hmm. And a big part of that has been also the history of the public markets and financing that industry. So I think there's stuff that's going to change. I don't know politically what's going to happen in the next little while, but it's interesting to me that like we have this resource base that doesn't necessarily earn Canadians that much money or de-risk our tax position and our fiscal, what would you call it? I don't know, the balance sheet of the government, right? So I think our high tax base is problematic for encouraging entrepreneurship. But then again, there's things that Canadians have that if exploited could bring that down. And so the future will show us what yields for that. But if we look at it, like, so we could sell resources all the world really, really well. We have them. We also have extremely attractive aesthetics and nature. And I don't see even 1% of what I would expect at this point in the year 2025 of Canadians taking on the responsibility of building globally focused hospitality businesses. Like, the world should be clamoring to visit us as tourists. This place should, you know, I started by critiquing the, like, if you're an entrepreneur mm-hmm. in, or if you're a leader in business, where do you hang out, right? And there's no hospitality solutions. That's crazy. I really looked like the aesthetics of Canada versus parallel them to Switzerland, right? Or Northern Italy, and say, we have the same topography. We have enough people that are young that are willing to work in cool things. How come no one's starting amazing hotels? Very few people are starting, you know, I would call it like, multi-SKU hospitality plays. I don't know. This is a great example. When were you in Banff last?
2019.
Yeah. Okay. So not that long ago, right? But Banff is still the same as it was as in the 80s. Like
it is. It is.
And that's a glorious thing in some ways, but at the same time, that is the pinnacle in a way of Canadian hospitality in its saleability, right? Like it's the easiest thing that we can, you could tell people about Banff in Japan and they would know what we're talking about.
Yeah. And you're right. There's a charm about it still being that same way, but I hear what you're saying too, and that it really hasn't changed in all those years. So you mentioned before, universities don't teach this. Like if you had the magic wand and could just change something, what would you be doing to encourage, teach, develop this entrepreneurial spirit? Would it be at the university level? Would it be in the education system? Would it be another, what would you do?
Okay, so it's tricky for me to recommend how education system can change because we have a lot of work to do. And I think every Canadian agrees that like our public school system is a travesty. We can applaud the work, of course, of the people working in it because they're doing good work, but they're under-resourced ridiculously. Like we can't have class sizes for, let's call it like 0 to grade 12 that are like 40 people per teacher. That doesn't make sense. Like why is that not changing? We can't have private schools so easily be seen as more attractive than a public school. What does that do to our social fabric in the neighborhoods where people live? It's ridiculous that you could have a neighborhood in a high-income area of Toronto where almost everyone in that neighborhood goes to a private school and that neighborhood's public school buses people in. Mm. You know, that sort of stuff is just stupid because it's about like imbalanced resource allocation and all that. So I'll say that like right from zero plus, like our school system needs a overhaul in terms of not just being relevant in its curriculum, but also needs a lot of support in bringing in educators and resources to make sure that going to school, being at school, being educated affords people the ability to learn and accelerates their capacity to learn. I don't think we think of it that way. I think we still think of it across the board in Canada as this like 1950s mentality of like run through this list and memorize it, you know, or the opposite of that, which is pick your nose and eat your boogers. So I'll leave that there. But I will say also that right now my lens is this. I'll say this. Because also, I'll tell you a little bit of something that Startwell's doing this June, which I think is exciting on this note. I think that Canada suffers from monopolistic thinking, and that's a dualistic identity where monopolies don't see anybody else because they're so big at this point and their moats are so large. So that's great. And they employ a lot of people, and the people that work there kind of maybe still thinking career track and they're not worried about disruption. Then you've got everyone else, and everyone else, their capacity to think with an innovation mindset is limited from birth because they've grown up amongst monopolies. If you talk to entrepreneurs in this country, they either feel like they're in a David versus Goliath kind of battle, like they're the small guy that's trying to disrupt the big industry, or like no one can mess with Loblaws, like because Galen Weston will just slap them with the nun that's better than their grandmother's. But like that's problematic for me, that we don't have a culture where entrepreneurship is celebrated for it being simply an approach to economic activity, right? But I think for me, I'm trying to work in encouraging companies to take on the onus, no matter what growth scale they are. This was one of the old hand claps for Google in the early days, but people used to applaud Google for a number of things, right? One was like, keeping the workers locked to their desks by massaging them and providing them with dry cleaning and buffet service, right? But the other thing was they would give people 20% of their time or something to work on pet projects. Now, the second part of the story that no one really reported on was those pet projects were still the IP of Google.
Mm.
So it's like, great, you hate your job, but one day a week you can do something cool and you're still not going to benefit from it. Yeah. And even at companies like Shopify that are like great, successful companies that have a delta on a performance element that they can leverage to encourage employees to do a better job of creating value. I think companies like that should wake up and say, instead of having the CEO reach out to the whole team, I don't know if you saw this recently, and say like AI is coming for you. And if you can't justify how AI can improve your job or replace you, you're replaceable. I don't know, whatever the phraseology was, right? But like Toby posts this like tweet or there was some memo and then it got tweeted out and he was very defensive about it saying, because as a coder CEO, he's thinking about efficiencies, efficiencies, efficiencies. But what if we had a reframing? And this is what I'm trying to encourage entrepreneurs to think is, and team leads and company leads is, what if 20%, let's call it just that, like a day a week, employees could do anything they want entrepreneurially, and the company is going to invest in that venture. So you don't own that venture, you're going to invest in that venture. That's just one brain fart thing that I think all companies could look at, right? So like I look at, there's a lot of companies, megacorps, that are building out corporate innovation kind of studios. And they're working with companies like Highline Beta, a Canadian company, doing great work building out these programs where you'll have a big company that might be, let's call it in like, I don't know, what are their examples? I don't know, top of mind, I don't know examples of their clients, but oh, here's one, Anheuser-Busch. So Anheuser-Busch, I believe, worked with them to say, we want to create this ideation studio, but we don't want to create the startups that would be competing against us for the new hot shit beer. What we want is looking at our supply chain. How can we innovate on a macro level and improve macroeconomics for everybody so that it has trickle-down effect on our business? And they seeded companies to do neat things for water purification and come up with different ways of like de-risking crop contamination, stuff like that. I think it's really, really cool, but it's a first step forward. And I think every company should be thinking about this stuff. Like people have so many inspired thoughts and they have so many things that they can undertake to provide value. And I think it's weird that companies are only focused on either bottom line or KPIs that are quarterly assessed as opposed to maybe encouraging of larger value exploration. So that's where I would kind of dig in a little bit. And that's where also we're kind of opening up forum now. So post-pandemic, I'm putting that behind us. Startwell is now starting programming again. We're bringing people together again. And this June, I'm doing a week of programming during the Toronto Tech Week.
I saw that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm calling it Tech for Canada. And what it is a five-day C-suite focused event. We're going to bring 500 C-suite leaders from all different companies here. And every day will be a different track for a different role. So a marketing day, you know, and a sales day and so on.
It's very smart.
But we've got very cool people coming to stage. And the idea is for the whole thing, I want everyone who comes to be thinking about partnership formation. In this new economy, like I think the Prime Minister this afternoon was on a live thing where he was once again reiterating that Canada's economy, according to the politicians, right, must undergo a reformation process. And the way I look at that, for any SMB that's kind of locked out of the benefits that monopolies encourage or enable, I think we need partnership formation. And we need to be able to, especially for B2B, be transacting between each other with as little friction as possible. A small company of, let's call it 100, 200 people, shouldn't have a procurement unit. They should have policies in place, depending on their nature of their business. But I guess the point is procurement shouldn't get in the way of deal flow. And partnerships, this is an interesting thing. It's the last note, but the way I'm looking at it, and I keep hearing it from people that I'm speaking with, is as companies have embraced in the last decade, the formation of partnership business units, which might be like an office of five or less people, they're taking the responsibility of forming deeper relationships with stakeholders out of sales, out of marketing, and out of the C-suite. So something we'll be talking about at the conference is how that can instead be a pervasive cultural value that company employees can always be looking for opportunities for their company to work with others. Because I think that's going to be massively important for the decade ahead.
Chasm, are we invited to that? Because that sounds really, really good.
100%. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Absolutely. Good. We'll talk after the days because I want to get that in my calendar.
Yeah.
I'm realizing a couple things through this conversation. I'm realizing we should have set aside 3 hours. to do this, honestly. So maybe next time we come down, we just sit around your table because, oh my gosh, like there's just so much value in this conversation. I know the audience is going to love it. But yeah, we should have set it across more time. And then as you were chatting about your childhood and then growing into a young person, I'm realizing, oh my God, I had such a boring life as I'm listening to that. And I'm thinking, I really need to step my game up at this point in my life to catch up. No, really, really fascinating though. Al's heard me say this before, and it's one of the reasons I love podcasting so much. And I believe in creating these moments in time. And I've talked on the podcast how before my mom passed away, I recorded with her and I created this moment in time, and it's going to be a gift to her grandkids so they could see who she was and the person she was, you know, at that time in her life. And, you know, I've always said, I love that saying that if a life's worth living, it's worth recording. And I think the reason why I love podcasting so much is I get to hear stories. And you've allowed us into your story today. And I think that's really part of the whole Startwell mission, right? Because you talked about you're having an event, people are behind stage. Why wouldn't you capture that? You know, that's a moment in time.
Right.
So, you know, we're running out of time and Al wants to get to his signature question because I definitely want to hear your answer. But why is storytelling so central to what you're building at Startwell?
It's a great question. Honestly, it's a really, really, really good question. And I think it's a question that's answered not just from the lens of Startwell, but my perspective on business in general. Like some of the work that we're doing, I haven't really announced it much, but I've taken on the project of enabling the Institute of Canadian Agencies, right, which is a representative body of 130 member communications companies that includes PR, marketing, advertising companies, huge ones, small ones, everyone. I've undertaken this role of helping them market that industry to the world. And it's a really interesting initiative because it comes back to something that I think is core. Brand. We don't invest in brand as Canadian businesses, and I think it's something that is unfortunate because when you don't tell your story, when companies don't share openly the motivations, the inspiration, the identity even of people that are behind the deals and that are operating a venture, I feel like what happens is you don't build trust with your stakeholders, or at least it's not as easy to build trust. And so what happens is the long tail is monopolies do a great job of being able to spend advertising dollars, right? And all the agencies have to sign up for like McDonald's. They're hoping that McDonald's, Bell, Rogers, Loblaws, they bring their multi-million dollar annual retainer so that their businesses can survive off that retainer. And the whole industry has been aligned for the most part to support that type of customer, which has done what? Which has applied our collective creativity that's professionally employed in Canada to buying the access to audience to drown out other original stories. That's the meta on it. And it's really interesting to me as I look to these agencies who are now wondering, well, what other customers can we bring on board? And at the same time, what they all suffer from themselves. This is a very interesting thing. They all suffer from the inability to articulate their brand. Like all agencies in Canada, these are marketers and they're very poor at telling their own story, and their representative body is handling the responsibility of marketing the marketing companies. So that's just an anecdote to say, I think I've always believed that brand and storytelling are intertwined, and to build a brand that actually engages people and customers and everyone else in your story, to do that is to actually, it's not just about like vulnerability and authenticity, you know. I think it goes deeper where it's about celebrating being able to have a relationship. Without telling your story, no one's going to assume even a tenth of your story. They don't have time to think about you. But once you've shared the relationship of trust, they won't forget you and they won't forget your story. So it's good on a brand building side of things, but I think it's also something that, you know, humanizes life. And so if companies embrace brand, I think everyone who involves themselves with that brand will have a better experience of it.
Well, I think you've done a really good job of that today for Startwell, because again, I've mentioned this on a couple of podcasts that we've done. Christine Song became a podcast guest, became a friend. We've had lunch with her before, and one of the comments that she has made to us was, love the podcast, it's fantastic, but I always want to find out who that person is behind the role. So I appreciate you opening up, because I think people walking away from this who haven't been down to Startwell yet will have a really good sense of who you are, what you're all about, the brand itself. So I think there should be more of that. And of course, that's through the podcast, we're trying to do that as well. And I found in my own career, success has come when I've let people in and they get to know who that person is. And you're right, you develop relationships that just go so much further when that happens, right? Well, we've arrived. And again, I see another podcast in our future. We're going to book off much more time to do it. But it's time of the podcast where Al asks his signature question. So if you're up for it, Chasm, we'd love to throw it at you.
Yeah, here we go. A society grows great when old persons plant trees in whose shade they will never sit. So looking back at your career and what you've done with Startwell, and maybe it's your personal life, what kind of legacy do you hope to leave behind through your work?
Oh, it's a good question. You know what? I don't think in terms of legacy, because I don't believe in there being a capacity amongst people to celebrate lessons learned posthumously in this media landscape, unfortunately. But I will say that, and again, it goes back to the brand thing, right? Like, the brand experience is something that is all powerful. It in itself is that legacy kind of thing where I want people to come away with an experience with my brand that leaves them feeling happier, more empowered, and the exact opposite of a poverty mindset. We want people to feel a sense of opportunity. It's a very powerful thing when you give people that, because I think there's too much out there these days in the commercial landscape that robs people of that, that makes people feel poor, that makes people's, you know, sense of opportunity feel limited. If you look at just simple consumerism critique, right? And one thing that we forget about in business is that businesses are made of people, and those people have their own lives. They are, even though they may work in a B2B life in their daytime, they're advertised to, right? They have cars that need upgrades and houses that need upgrades and cottages that don't exist yet and all these things. So I think the pressures on employees and the pressures on people, when they come together to meet for a business function, our goal, of course, through our brand is to let them forget about all those anxieties, worries, no matter what their origination is, and experience something that's true and honest together. And what we find, this is amazing, and it fuels me, is we've found over the last few years, especially post-pandemic, as people have kind of gotten comfortable coming together again. Let's talk about the last 2 years, 2023-24. We found that guaranteed within the first 5 minutes of a team meeting at Startwell, you'll hear laughter. And we'll also find that people will teach each other where things are. They'll also teach each other about how to use things here. The whole experience, I mean, this is something I've kind of designed a little bit, but it's about empowering people with a sense of ownership. And then they share that ownership with each other. And that itself, I think, is a core value of co-working. But that's a beautiful thing. And I think if there's any legacy kind of like that I want to leave behind, or this business should when it goes bankrupt, is, or, you know, multinational or whatever, I think is that everyone has an opportunity to leave an impression from the experience they have with someone else and through their company. And I think the more experiences that we benefit from, the better the world is.
Chasm, I thank you for that. And I agree with Robin. This has been a great conversation. We could have kept going. I'm sure there's a lot more we can talk about, but I know we do have to wrap it up today.
My pleasure, guys. Honestly, it was awesome spending some time. And I'm looking forward to the next time that we meet. We'll definitely have you back in June for our conference here at Startwell.
Oh, we'll be back.
Oh, would love that. And a couple of shout outs again. Cara, you're such a gem. You're such a super connector. So thank you for this, because I feel like a friendship is on its way, which is great. And we'll give a shout out to Hassan, because again, giving that elevated experience from the moment you walk in. And, you know, Chasm's talked about getting a beautiful cappuccino or a coffee or whatever it happens to be that is your taste buds. But there is also a tea bot. And that's all I'm going to say about that. So to find out what the T-Bot is, you'll have to come down to Starwell and find out what that is. But yes, it is definitely an elevated experience. And of course, we had a recording that you're going to see come out very, very soon. And I think you'll agree, it's just a wonderful space with some wonderful people. For listeners interested in finding more about what you're doing at Starwell, what's the best way to reach out?
Yeah, I mean, our website is startwell.co. That's startwell.co. It's a real thing, .co, not .com or .ca. You could just reach out to me directly via email if anyone's interested in it. Just the letter Q at startwell.co. And our phone number is 647-799-5566. One thing I will recommend to people listening is if you go to our website, please poke around, spend some time, enjoy it, because there's a lot of like Easter eggs. And if you click into our magazine section, you'll see podcasts that are mainly video podcasts, as well as some resources for anyone planning meetings and events. So it doesn't need to be at Startwell. We're trying to provide a lot of value for people that are in that role and people in culture, HR, whatever it is. So yeah. And if anyone listening, watching, you know, wants to reach out to me, please don't feel apprehensive. Just drop me a line and whatever it's about, we can chat.
That's awesome. Well, that does it for today's episode. Really enjoyed this conversation. As always, we hope you did too. If you have any questions for Al or myself, please feel free to give us a call or by joining the conversation on LinkedIn. We saw it here very clearly. Success leaves clues. We'll see you next time, my friends.